The Quran has a lot to say about Jesus. He's mentioned over a dozen times. In fact, the Quran does record one particular miracle of Jesus as a child, where he impresses his friends by blowing on a clay pigeon and causing it to become alive.
Doesn't that come from the Gospel of Thomas?
I think it's also in the Arabic infancy gospel.
Interesting.
Yeah, there are a couple places in the Quran that are almost a verbatim transcription from Talmudic or non-canonical Christian sources.
On this edition of the White Horse Inn, part two of Michael Horton's conversation with Islam specialist Adam Francisco.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
What are the sources? Obviously, people think of the Quran, and you mentioned the Hadith. What are the sources? Are they all on a par with each other? Or,
yeah, complicated question. If you ask a Sunni Muslim who's a traditionalist of some sort, what his or her source on Islam is, they certainly won't say their heart, their emotions. They will say, the phrase they'll usually give is Quran and Sunnah. Quran, their scriptural text, and Sunnah is just a term meaning tradition. But what it refers to is the tradition established by Muhammad and the first few generations of Muslims. In other words, anything that's recorded about what Muhammad said and did that didn't make its way into the Quran, that's been passed down orally, but it has been checked through what they call a chain of transmission, that it comes from a legitimate source, the wife of Muhammad or a companion of Muhammad, that is considered, in a sense, revelatory as well. Muhammad is regarded as the perfect man. When he spoke under inspiration, it's as if Allah spoke directly through him. That's put down in the Quran. When he conducts himself in jihad or when he's ruling on domestic issues and it's not directly from Allah, because he's the prophet of Allah, in a sense, it's inspired as well. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who's from—
So what he says and what he does.
Yeah. A friend from Lebanon who says, and I've never been able to find this online and I don't care to go over there and learn— says that Islam tells you everything from how to urinate to how to rule an empire and everything in between, all from the example of Muhammad.
Wow.
That doesn't mean there aren't gray areas that later Muslim jurists fill in. They certainly do, using deduction and analogical reasoning, but it's those sources. So in the Sunnah, you have what's called the Hadith, and there are a number of collections, some that have more authority than others, depending on whether the chain of transmission goes back to a contemporary of Muhammad or not. Then what's called the Sirah, these are biographies of Muhammad, which date about 180 years after he's dead, so their historical veracity is questionable. And then there are other early accounts of Islam and the early Islamic conquest that are by many Muslims regarded as authoritative as well as the proper conduct of Islam.
Now, when you go to these sources, what emerges as a picture of who Jesus was?
Yeah, the Quran has a lot to say about Jesus. He's mentioned over a dozen times. Chapter 19 probably gives the most detail. We learn that, or the Quran says that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary. In fact, Mary is the only female named in the Quran. He grows up, performs over the course of his life lots of miracles. The Quran doesn't get into the particulars, but does say he healed the sick, raised the dead, and so on.
So was born of a virgin.
Was born of a virgin, performs miracles. In fact, the Quran does record one particular miracle of Jesus young as a child, where he impresses his friends by blowing on a clay pigeon and causing it to become alive.
Doesn't that come from the Gospel of Thomas, the Gnostic?
I think it's also in the Arabic infancy gospel.
Interesting.
There are a couple places in the Quran that are almost a verbatim transcription from Talmudic or non-canonical Christian sources.
Interesting.
Jesus, then, we don't get to a whole lot about the content of his teaching. He's regarded as a prophet of Allah. In fact, right after he's born, his first miracle was, according to chapter 19 of the Quran, he's placed in a cradle. He looks up. Mary's a bit distraught because she's not married and has a child, and she has to explain to her family how this happened. And Jesus looks up and comforts her by saying, "Don't worry, Mary, I am a prophet of Allah."
And he says this as an infant.
As an infant, yeah. As a newborn.
Yeah.
So he's regarded as a prophet of Allah and a prophet of Islam, but a prophet of Islam to the nation of Israel. His prophetic ministry was constrained to that group of people. Towards the end of his life, there's a picture in Quran chapter 4, 157, or a statement in 4:157 that says, "The Jews say that they crucified the Christ, the Messiah." And Jesus is regarded as the Messiah, al-Masih in the Quran, which is just an honorific title. There's another Messiah in Islam, the Mahdi, who has more supernatural functions and powers. But the Jews say they crucified the Messiah. No, they did not crucify him, nor was he killed. And in the exegetical tradition, all the commentaries on the Quran, you see lots of different theories are given. The prominent one is Jesus, on that night before he was to be betrayed, was sitting around with his disciples, and he asked them who wants to take his place for what's to come. And Judas raises his hand. His face is transformed so that he looks like Jesus, and Jesus is taken up into heaven, and Judas is eventually crucified in his place.
But now for something completely different.
Yeah, and he's still up in the second or third realm of heaven. There are seven levels to heaven in Islamic thought, and he's waiting for to return at the last day. Quran chapter 5, verses 117 and 118 says that at the last day, when all the dead are raised and the living are raised up with them and everybody's being judged on the basis of their good or bad deeds, Jesus will come down and Allah will point to a group of Christians, perhaps all Christians, and say to Jesus, "Did you tell them that they should regard you and your mother Mary as God, that they should take you as lords?" And Jesus responds saying, "I would have never told them such a thing. I would have never told them what you did not tell me to tell them." So an odd type of Christianity that allegedly confesses Jesus, the Son of God, and Mary is a part of God as well, is renounced. Then the picture goes on, and it's more developed in the traditional literature, that Jesus, after that judgment, will join forces with the Islamic Mahdi, the Islamic Messiah, and find every crucifix that's ever been made and crush it. We'll hunt down pigs and kill every last pig on earth. And this is more of a spurious tradition, say that we'll also hunt down the Jews and persecute and kill them as well.
Wow. Is there any gospel, any good news in Islam, or is it all law?
It is all law. I think the best way to illustrate this is, I mean, you can read the Quran and see that it's filled with legal or moral injunctions, and that though you can never be sure, your eternal destiny, your whether you're going to heaven or hell, is largely dependent upon whether you've really followed the Sharia or stayed on the straight path.
You can be sure if you're a martyr,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's the only way. But even then, the Quran says, if you die as a martyr, when you go up and you're enjoying your 70 or 72 virgins and everything, drinking as much wine as you want without getting a headache, the Quran says, because it was such
an
honor.
Which you can't do on earth.
Right, right. It's such an honor to die as a martyr that you'll petition that you could go back and die in the cause of Allah again. So, but anyway, I think the best way to illustrate the legal orientation of Islam is time and time again, I've had this conversation with Muslims. After we've had the apologetic discussion, perhaps it opens up their mind a bit to maybe reading a gospel, an eyewitness or a companion of eyewitness on the real Jesus. I always ask them the classic evangelistic question, what about your salvation? Can you be certain of this? Mm-hmm. If you were to die, can you be certain you'd wake up in heaven? And the response is always, no, I couldn't be certain, nor do I care. Mm-hmm. I remember one Lutheran convert to Islam, a young woman, once told me that her concern and the concern of any Muslim is just to be a good submitter to Allah. That's their concern. And what Allah does with them in the afterlife, already been predetermined.
So that in conversations I've had with Muslims, one of the things that strikes me is that although it claims to be an Abrahamic, quote unquote, Abrahamic faith and therefore historical, based on some sort of history, when you talk to them about the disparity between the historical record we have of Jesus Christ and the eyewitness accounts and the credibility of those accounts and so forth versus the non-verified or non-verifiable accounts surrounding Muhammad, they don't care. Basically, in case after case at least, it has been very much, look, this is about law. This is about how I live. The historical arguments just don't really matter to me. It's almost like I have this burning in my bosom. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what I'm committed to. Does that indicate the paradigmatic difference with Christianity, which is all about promise and fulfillment, not just, you know, a list of imperatives, but about God's fulfilling a plan of salvation, redemption, from Genesis to Revelation, that this is real history. Now, if people say they don't care about either good news or the history on which it's based, how do we then, as Christians, strike up conversations with Muslims?
Good question. I've been pondering this for a long time because I, in speaking with Muslims, you oftentimes run up against a dead wall, like other people who are committed to a pretty strong ideology. Mm-hmm. Worldviews or ideologies are, I don't know if they're 100% determinative, but they oftentimes do certainly inform how one is going to take or understand an argument or look at evidence. Apologetically speaking, I think I've had a little bit of a success with this, sticking with the evidence. And if you have some sort of rapport, a friendly rapport with a Muslim, getting them to face the evidence and not letting them go, because you're friends, you can have this conversation until they answer your questions. The question I typically use is, why do you take a 7th century text 600 years removed from a person it claims to speak about when we have two eyewitnesses, two companions of eyewitnesses, and a whole lot of other evidence on this person? And, you know, they'll get into the issue of, well, those sources have been corrupted. Mm-hmm. And nowadays what you're seeing is that Muslims are starting to use, though they're not interested in a historical inductive argument, they will use historical arguments polemically to try to bring down the claims of Christianity, and they'll use men like Bart Ehrman and the scholarship of biblical, the higher criticism masquerading as text criticism. Mm. And I'm an advocate of friendship evangelism, but friendship isn't the end. Mm-hmm. The end should be somehow getting or speaking the gospel and defending the gospel before a Muslim. And it has to be in a context where you can have these conversations over an extended period of time where feelings won't get hurt, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And it's complicated.
When the Quran says, for example, that each person is weighed by his own merits, one person cannot bear the sins of another, and yet they consider the Old Testament, for instance, authoritative in some sense, what do they do with something like Isaiah 53, where he says, and he bore our sins?
That particular passage, I'm not sure my assumption would be based on the way they treat the Old Testament generally, is when they find passages in the Old Testament that seem to look forward to Christ and the sacrifice of Christ on the cross and the atonement of sins, they'll either say, well, that was the passage has been corrupted. It's been altered or amended a bit to support a Christian theology. Christian scribes did that at some point. They can't give evidence of where this took place, especially now with the Dead Sea Scrolls confirming the Masoretic Hebrew text. Or they'll say, well, there's another way we can interpret it. And some of the suggestions are ridiculous. It's
But wherever it's consistent with the Quran and the Hadith, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's uncorrupted.
Mm-hmm.
But wherever it disagrees,
yes,
they put up the corruption flag, and or there's another interpretation that explains it away.
Yeah. The Quran sometimes is called Al-Furqan, which means the distinguisher. It's the lens through which not only you view the world, but through which you can view the earlier books that were revealed through Allah's prophets, Moses, David, and Jesus. And you can distinguish what still holds, but also what's been corrupted or what must be pushed to the side or marginalized or suppressed. But practically speaking, Muslims don't read the Old or the New Testament for any religious value. It's primarily if they read it, and it's usually they're reading books on it, it's for mostly polemical purposes, to find those what we might call difficulties, what they would call contradictions and corruptions of the biblical text.
Interesting. Is there a textual critical, not even higher critical, but textual critical industry, school, practice, method in Islam regarding its texts?
It's starting. It's just started as of maybe 10 years ago. Maybe you could push it back to 20 years ago. In the 1970s, though, there was a movement that started that was eventually it quieted down for a while until issues with Islam became much more popular, more of a revisionist approach to Islamic history. That said, in the past, critical Western scholars have just simply assumed the traditional narrative Muslims have passed down on the origins of Islam was true. And it all comes from Muslim texts. All these texts are 150 years or more after the event. And so we need to look at other evidence that we have. There's archaeological and non-Muslim sources that tell us a slightly different story of the emergence of Islam that might cause us to re-envision its history. For example, around 634, 2 years after Muhammad's death, the Arab armies come out of the Arabian Peninsula and make their way into Palestine or the Holy Land and eventually Syria. And there's no mention of them having a different religion. It just looks like a political contest. Some scholars have said, well, that's because Islam wasn't around yet. It's developed over time. And the earliest Quranic manuscripts that we have, they were found in Yemen in the late 1970s and have been studied since then. They show, and you can even go on Google and type in Yemen manuscripts of the Quran and get pictures of the manuscript, and you see that there are different layers to this text. That is, it was written down, then you can see somebody wiped it away and then wrote another text on top of it that looks like the earlier text, but things are changed a bit. And then another layer after that one's been wiped away. But over history, it's come up. The ink that they use has come up. Mm. So it maybe was developed. Now, with regard to the Quran, there is the old higher critics who are still with us are turning their sights on the Quran. Mm. The problem is that what they come up with, they have to publish through places like Prometheus Press. So it doesn't have a wide readership. It has usually those who are very, the more read the stuff. There is a more text critical school that's been around for some time, but in the last, 6 years has been working on producing a critical edition of the Quran, sort of the equivalent to the Nestle Alon version of the New Testament, where in looking at all the manuscripts that they've been able to acquire over however many decades, that any time Quranic manuscripts differ from the received Egyptian text, they would indicate that in a footnote down in the scholarly apparatus. And that was supposed to be published a couple of years back, 2 or 3 years ago. And I recall an announcement going out, because I was looking forward to it. It should upset at least the Muslim claim that the Quran has been perfectly preserved, because it has not. The facts say otherwise. But it wasn't published, and so there was a press release I recall reading some time ago that said for political reasons, and they've stalled the publication of this critical edition indefinitely.
Interesting.
There are some books out there, if you want me to go on this topic. One popular one called a Syrio-Aramaic Reading of the Quran. that says there are passages in the Quran. It starts off with this idea that in these passages of the Quran that seem to be borrowed from the Christian tradition, if we transcribe and transliterate out of the Arabic into Syro-Aramaic or Syriac, what you'd find is you can find almost a one-for-one match from that Syriac transliteration to heretical Christian liturgies.
Interesting.
That's Christoph Luxemburg. And it is available in English. It was originally a German book. The name of the author is a pseudonym for perhaps obvious reasons.
Yeah.
and there are other texts like that out there that are becoming available.
It is interesting how Christians are expected to back down in the face of secularism, but Islam kind of gets a free pass. There's intimidation, and secularists even, they back down. They'll go after, maybe because they were raised in the Bible Belt themselves and feel just fine going after their former pastors. But there's a kind of liberty given to Islam to almost intimidate governments and to kind of demand preferential treatment in some countries, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a movement in the UN and elsewhere to stifle criticism of religion, but what they mean and the ones who are behind it are Muslims. Hmm. If there is one religion that's protected, even in here in America, it would be Islam. Think of the Quran burning controversies. Everybody's up at arms at that, and people are being disciplined in the military for doing that. But when they burned in Afghanistan a whole bunch of Bibles, mm-hmm. you didn't even hear it on the news.
Oh, interesting.
Now, I don't know if that's as big of an issue as just the whole walling off Islam from criticism is.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't
that say something, too, about the difference between Christianity and Islam? Fine, we'll get some more Bibles. You know, for us, a Bible is not a quasi-idol. Mm. It's the proclamation. Mm-hmm. It's the Word of God that goes out and creates faith and so forth. But I came across an interesting article in the New York Times where they were baffled. The editors were baffled at how it was that in the case of the accidental burning of a bunch of Qurans by the military, that caused widespread riots and even some deaths. Whereas the editors pointed out there was almost no reaction to the sergeant, the U.S. sergeant, who kind of went nuts mm-hmm. and killed 17 unarmed civilians in Afghanistan. And they asked that question of several imams. And to a man, every one of these imams said, yeah, human life is worth nothing compared to the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the Quran for them is... it's as close to a sacrament as Islam might get, or as close to an incarnation as Islam might get. The Quran is regarded as the inscripturation of Allah's word. In Sunni Islamic thought, when the Quran is recited correctly, it's as if Allah is speaking from all eternity. And so, I mean, it is their idol, so to speak. It's their God who has come down to us.
Quasi-incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. There is no redeemer in Islam, is there? There are prophets, there are lawyers, there are lawyers who interpret lawyers, but there is no redeemer,
right.
Is there?
Right. And they reject the notion that there could be one, that one could die for the sins of another. That's rejected in the very pages
so
of the Quran.
Completely do your best and hope that that'll be enough for Allah.
Yeah, that's about it.
Wow. In terms of personal witness to fellow Muslims, we have neighbors who are Muslim and our kids play with their kids every day. And, you know, when they have talked to them about the gospel, they kind of get the whole, look, we all worship the same God. Let's not talk about this. And it's really difficult to know how to talk to their parents who are pretty committed Muslims but don't want to talk about mm-hmm. religion. Now you've got the insider movement and lots of missionaries who've been involved in Muslim countries for a long time, quietly, slowly, bringing people to Christ and baptizing them quietly, who now see Western missionaries arguing we ought to let people remain Muslim followers of Jesus. In the midst of all of this, tremendous pressure to either be silent or maybe to be as confusing in our message as Islam is about, you know, whether it's a political crusade or a proclamation of the gospel. How do we find our way? Because we're going to be here for a long time mm-hmm. with our Muslim neighbors. And how do we engage them, love them, be good neighbors with them, share Christ with them, while also being aware that Islam is more than a religion, it's a political movement?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? With regard to evangelism and our Muslim neighbors, I've found, and I don't know if you found this with your Muslim neighbors, that in terms of the way we view our family and life, you know, what's important in life, family and what we might call civil righteousness, that's important to Muslims as well. There are things that they find abhorrent, that we find abhorrent about our culture, pornography, some, though it's not as strong in Islam, you know, pro-life issues, matter, things like this. And I've found time and again, Muslims express some sort of shock as they learn more about me, of my conservative social values. They assume that all Christians are either, probably because the Christians who are engaging in interfaith dialogue are typically from the liberal Protestant sector. They've not met a whole lot of Reformation Christians who are friendly and, in the proper sense, evangelical. And so I think nurturing those relationships on one side, in one realm, are vital. But how do you do that for a person like me who's pretty vocal about the political side of Islam? That always colors or taints the waters a bit. And how to navigate that is something I have not figured out yet. It's because usually what I won't, when I'm speaking with Muslims, whether it be like my son in his Taekwondo studio, there are a number of Muslim people who send their kids there and we'll have little conversations, but I do not tell them what my profession is, because if they go online, they're going to find stuff that is very critical of Islam, and that will just sour things immediately.
So the most important thing here is don't talk about them, talk to them in personal witness.
Yeah. It's simply, speaking to them like another human being. They are humans. They're our neighbors. We're to defend them, speak well of them, treat them the way we would anybody else. At the same time, I do think, and it doesn't necessarily have to be publicly, but we have to be very concerned about the intrusion of Islam and especially the attempt to advance Islamic causes in our political or civil landscape. The big push here in Orange County, and it's starting to fan out across the country, is to argue that under the First Amendment, Muslims have every right to practice the Sharia law. And they of course, won't define what the Sharia law is. They just use this sort of abstract concept. The next argument, it was just made 3 weeks ago at the Orange County Islamic Center here, that the Sharia law, in fact, is commensurate with U.S. constitutional law.
Wow.
And now, again, they won't define it. Mm-hmm. And you start asking questions, well, what about beating your wife? They'll quickly stifle that conversation. They won't answer those questions.
But ideally, they would like that to be handled in an Islamic court rather than in a state or federal court.
Absolutely. Just like Jews, for example, are allowed to, when it comes to some domestic issues, a marriage law, inheritance and things, are in some places in the country, in England and other places, allowed to have their own domestic courts, I think you call them. So they're in a way, they're just saying we should be treated like others. But what they're driving at is a greater intrusion of Islam into our national, political, civil infrastructure. So
Sam Solomon, a friend we've had on a couple of times, he was a Sharia lawyer and had to leave the country for his life after his baptism, and has testified in Parliament and in U.S. Congress in various subcommittees on what Islamic goals are, at least in the last 40 years. And one of the points that he has made repeatedly is that there is a sweeping movement across Europe that you now are beginning to see in the United States. It's more pronounced in the Netherlands and Scandinavia and Britain, but a movement to have these ummahs, these alternative political arrangements where you almost have a state within a state. Do you think that that is increasingly where we're headed in the United States?
I do think we will get to that point. We're really far behind, very far behind what's taking place in Europe. But I think we should plan on it. Hopefully it doesn't happen, but I do think we will get there. You do have a number of organizations in America. Probably Islamic Society of North America is one of the more pronounced that is in a way striving towards that. They have a legal side, the Fiqh Council of North America, that does rule on particular Muslim issues in a secular context. One of the hot-button issues a couple of years back was whether Muslims could drink Coca-Cola because there's a minuscule amount of alcohol in it. And they issued a fatwa saying, yeah, you can, because it's not enough. You could drink 100 cans of Coke and not feel any sort of intoxicating effects.
Well, now, but that's legitimate, right, for a religion to be able the Pope can tell people that they can't use contraceptives. And
sure,
and
it certainly is. And
where does it cross the line?
I think certainly it crosses the line when it reaches constitutional issues. I mean, that's probably obvious. But also just our civil code, our basic civil code, I think it becomes an issue. Issues like whether a Muslim woman can wear a head covering of some sort in her passport or driver's license photo. Those sorts of issues, I think, arrive at the point of where we need to be concerned.
So this is just walking a fine line, isn't it, of being on one hand citizens of the kingdoms of this age where we care very much about civil freedom and civil democracy, and so we're going to oppose the encroachment on our constitutional liberties, and yet on the other hand, not wanting to confuse that with our evangelism and our witness to Christ and give people the impression that basically it's your cultural political religion versus our cultural political religion.
Yeah.
Which is what we're hearing a lot. You know, this is, again, isn't it why we need Reformation Christianity again?
Because absolutely, yeah.
A lot of the people who are outspoken against the Islamicization of Europe and America are also fairly one kingdom people who think that, you know, in one breath talk about politics and culture, and in the next breath talk about how superior Jesus is to Allah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I find myself in all sorts of strange companies sometimes where it's assumed that if you're a Christian and you're concerned about Islam, that you're, of course, going to be a Zionist as well. And when you start making this distinction, this civil sacred realm distinction, lots of, especially evangelical Christians, get very, they sort of write you off as you must be some sort of liberal.
Yeah.
If you're open to a more pluralistic civil order.
And we're saying, no, that's actually, we're drawing on our own confessional history here, that we haven't been consistent on.
Yeah. That's another point, being consistent ourselves and not just going after Islam heavy-handedly, but perhaps these other Christian traditions that not only confuse law and gospel, but confuse the two kingdoms and so on.
Wow. Lots more we could discuss here. This is only scratching the surface, but it has been fascinating to talk to you, Adam, and I hope that we can have you on again to update this. And I'm sure our listeners will want to read your work and follow your writing and research on the subject. Truth Unlocked is another resource you contributed to. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, it's a DVD series. There are six or seven of us from across Canada and the United States, three or four converts to Christianity from Islam, and then three Christian scholars of Islam, where we I think it's about 6 or 8 hours long, but it's in segments that are designed for study sessions, Bible study type settings, on the nature of Islam, how to approach your Muslim neighbor, and issues like that. Hmm. It's available. You can just type it in Google, but Tobias Communications distributes that.
Truth Unlocked.
Mm-hmm. Truth Unlocked, Keys to Reaching Your Muslim Neighbor is the subtitle.
Terrific. Adam, thanks a lot for being with us on the White
Horse
Inn.
You're welcome. It was great being here.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.